Welcome back, underdogs. This is Mike Schwartz, your pilot for episode 17. Your destination is an interview with the founders of Timescale, a popular time series database with a handy SQL interface. In just 22 months, the database has over 1 million downloads and the company has raised $27.4 million. To keep things interesting, we're having a little change in format. This week, we have two guests, co-founder AJ Kulkarni and Mike Friedman. They might be a little hard to tell apart at first. AJ is the CEO, and he does most of the talking initially. Mike is the CTO, a professor at Princeton, and his contribution is slightly more techy. Timescale has written a fantastic blog about building a self-sustaining business model in the era of cloud computing. I created a short link to it, https://glu.co/timescale. But before you read that, let's get to the podcast. So without further ado, here we go. AJ and Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Although this is a business podcast, in layman's term, what is a time series database and what kind of applications is that good for?
It's a great question, and maybe I'll start by describing what is time series data. And I think this technically defined, time series data is a data set where you're essentially measuring something over time. So, you know, every data point has a timestamp and a new measurement. Put another way, time series data measures how things change over time. And typical sources of time series data, you know, I think historically have been things like the financial industry, where you have tick data with stocks and other, you know, commodities. I think more recently you've seen time series data emerge from the DevOps market, where you have people measuring all types of systems and workloads and services. But I think one thing we found today is that time series data has been emerging in more and more places. A lot of this is the rise of machine data and IoT. Broadly speaking, we now see time series data measuring oil and gas sensors and wells. You see it in manufacturing. You see power plants. The logistics market is measuring time series over space and time. You know, even the consumer world, wearables is time series data. And then Uber or Lyft is collecting data points over time and space. That's time series data. And so long story short, time series data is a niche workload that has in the past few years kind of exploded and become ubiquitous. Because of that, of that change, we've seen the rise of time series databases, which I think was your original question. And what we found with time series databases is that, well, number one, time series data, because you're collecting measurements over time, as you can imagine, the data piles up very quickly. And so fairly soon you get databases that are in the hundreds of millions or billions of rows, which leads us to certain scalability and performance challenges. What time series databases do in general is that they essentially optimize for this workload in a way that allow you to get increased performance with much fewer resources. You know, so maybe, you know, less disk, less RAM, a smaller box will get you further because they're optimized for this workload. And because of the growth of time series data and the rise of time series databases in general now have been the fastest growing category of databases over the past 24 months. A couple other things is that, you know, it's not just performance, but time series databases also introduce additional usability aspects that are useful for this workload. For example, special analytical queries on time series data and other things that traditional databases just weren't designed to do.
At what point did Timescale, the company, get started? Was it before or after or at the same time as the community coalesced around the software?
You know, we have a funny story, which I actually think is not that uncommon. Timescale, the company, started in 2015, but actually under a different name and a different premise. So we started off building an IoT platform. And long story short, we were collecting a lot of time series data from over 100,000 devices. And we needed a time series database to store this data. We used a few off-the-shelf items, and they didn't really satisfy our needs. So the first version of Timescale was actually just something we built internally for our own needs. And very quickly, the people who were using the platform, or even the people who were, you know, we were describing the platform to, were more interested in the database. And so while it's not the classic Kafka, Hadoop, Spark community model, there were quite a few people who were using and interested in Timescale, the database, before the company officially became Timescale.
But I think the interesting thing is even some of those companies that Ajay mentioned, Kafka and Confluent, it's not unusual for these open source technologies to start inside a place. In that case, it was a much larger LinkedIn, while for us, it was our own startup. But they were created because they were designed to scratch your own itch. And the interesting thing about that, which I think reflects on also how we're different as technology from a lot of the other time series databases, which came by initially narrowly focusing on something like DevOps, is that we were looking at this IoT setting where you often had complex data, you wanted to make complex queries, you want to join the data, enrich the data with other business or metadata you had. So that led us down a path to build something for our own needs. And then, of course, it turns out that those needs are widely shared across many industries.
And so what ended up happening is that we ended up repositioning the company and relaunching as Timescare early 2017. And in the beginning, our only thinking was, hey, this would be a great database for IoT because that's where we came from. And as soon as we launched, I think we had this funny moment where a few weeks after we launched, we had more press on Timescale than we did in the last probably year of our IoT platform. And it was this funny moment, we're like, wow, this thing is actually way bigger than we thought. And it's even larger than IoT. And that's when we realized that there are a few trends that were broader trends that are coalescing. One was the rise of time series data. The other was the resurgence of SQL as a query language. And when we launched, and even today, you know, we're the only time series database that supports SQL. And number three was the resurgence of Postgres. And in fact, Postgres has been the, I think, fastest growing database over the past 2 years. And number two is Mongo, just to show you how fast Postgres is growing. And the way Timescale is packaged is that we're actually engineered on top of Postgres. So we look and feel just like Postgres, the outside world. And so this intersection of time series, SQL, Postgres, and scalability, and we were right at that intersection. And I think as a result, as soon as we launched, the response in the community was way larger than we had expected.
So the community seems to really want to use Timescale, but how has the community been in terms of contributions and feedback, and what value has the community added to the development process?
I think the community has been very valuable in a couple different ways. One is we actually host a large Slack community with around 2,000 people, and these are a lot of our most active users who ask questions, help each other, help direct what future features are in want. So, you know, community contributes in a couple different ways. One, as you point out, traditionally, you know, sometimes that means development. But, you know, I think in many open source projects too, there's this long process of getting community people doing a lot of core development where in the, particularly towards the beginning, it's more things like smaller features, bug fixes, whatever. But I think the value of a community is much more than that. It's also people building you into reference architectures that other could use, people help developing and showing best practices or deployments in different scenarios, and also learning from what this community needs to really help design a product and engineering roadmap that fits the wants.
We have essentially a public Slack channel, which is where a good chunk of our community lives. You know, right now, I think it's in the thousands of people, which is where we get product feedback, any bugs that they find, but also where the community helps each other in terms of onboarding and use cases, where someone will say, hey, you know, who's using Timescale for, say, NetFlow? And someone else will jump in and say, oh, like, this is how we're using it. And we think that's great. So it's really showing like a collaborative community that kind of drives growth in a way that we don't need to be very forceful about it.
One more comment on that. You know, the interesting thing about Timescale as the technology is that it's very flexible, given the fact that partly related to how we really focus on providing what looks like full SQL and kind of full schemas or even JSON or whatever, we could be used a lot of different ways, as opposed to a lot of things that were narrowly built for DevOps or whatever that were really super opinionated about how you should store your data. And what that means for us then is that there's many different settings in IoT, for example. The way you actually want to store your data or have a data model is different, for example, if you have 10,000 sensors of the same type, or you might have 50 different types of sensors all collecting at the same time, or you have different locations and you don't want to actually connect the data, or you have lots of different things which could be giving you different types of data almost in an arbitrary fashion. And so Timescale supports all of them, but you actually want to use a slightly different data model depending upon, you know, the huge heterogeneity at which you could use it. And that's also where you find the community helping to develop best practices and help each other out as part of their journey.
So switching topics a little bit, Timescale has a really interesting licensing model. You have a core Apache 2 version of Timescale. Mm-hmm. You have your own timescale license, which are called TSL. And within TSL, you have both free and commercial features. Can you explain a little bit about the rationale behind this license design?
For sure. And just to be clear, you know, it's essentially one code base. And in that code base, we have probably at this point, 99% of the code is Apache 2. We're just starting to add some TSL features and nothing has been relicensed. Essentially, all our original Apache 2 code is still Apache 2. I think what's interesting is that when you're developing an open source project, you have to balance different needs. You know, on one hand, you have to balance the needs of people who are somewhat, you know, passionate, I would say, about open source licensing, and they really want like an OSI approved license. But there are folks, you know, for example, in larger enterprises who don't care as much about whether something's OSI approved, but they really just want to see the source code and see what they're running. And as well, there's this whole user experience problem, which is like, people want to be able to migrate from different versions without downtime or migrating data. And this is essentially what we are trying to balance with this new model, which we didn't invent. It's really similar to what, for example, Elastic has been doing, is that this code base has Apache 2. And in fact, the vast majority is Apache 2, but there are also some TSL features, and some of the TSL features are free and some are commercial. And we essentially give people the choice, and we can say, look, if you really want an Apache 2 version, you can build that from source, or here are a set of Apache 2 only binaries that you can install, and it's great. Other folks, we can say, hey, like, if what you really care about is free, but you're not as, maybe religious about open source, here is a free binary with Apache 2 and TSL features that you can run, and you can even compile that from source, and great. And then the third folks are like, hey, like, if you're, say, a larger company and you have some really critical needs, and for you, because of your type of business, you're not opposed to paying for open source. And in fact, maybe you like paying for open source because that gives you a general set of accountability that you wouldn't have otherwise, and maybe indemnifications and other features. Here's a commercial binary that you can pay for. And I think what we essentially try to do with this licensing model is provide that flexibility, but have it all in the same repo, so it's all transparent. So in other words, the same workflows you could use to see what open source features are down the pipeline, you can still use those features to see what enterprise features are down the pipeline. And this is our way to be more transparent and to engage the community more. And what we see now is people filing GitHub issues on proprietary features. And that's kind of the behavior that we're trying to facilitate.
So what's the core value proposition for the enterprise part of the software?
What we found is that some features that are useful to the broader community, from startups to large enterprises, a lot of those features include usability, like ease of use and performance. And those are either in open source or the free community tier. But there are some features that really become relevant when you're deploying timescale production. And those are the ones that are in the commercial offering. A few examples of that are around data lifecycle management, that if you're running a time series workload at scale, over time, you have issues around maybe data retention, performance, around trying to optimize resource utilization. And for these features, what we've done is we've said, look, if all you want to do is use the database, it's free. But if you want it to be highly tuned and optimized in an automated fashion where you don't have to be involved, which is typically what you see for a large-scale production workload, that's in the commercial version. So the initial commercial offering essentially boxes all that into automated data lifecycle management. That's in our enterprise tier.
So there must be other timescale databases out there. How do you differentiate yourself from those offerings?
Right. Well, I mean, number one, there's only one timescale database, but there are multiple time series databases out there. The whole reason that timescale exists is that when we were building our previous company, that we tried to probably half a dozen of the existing time series databases that were already there. And they didn't work. And the main reason why they didn't work for us was because we just wanted something that supported SQL and the relational data model. And so we built that. And when we built it, people thought we were crazy. It's kind of heretical to try to build a time series database on a relational database and support full SQL. But we felt that that was important because SQL is easy to use and we already knew it. So we found no reason to try to teach ourselves and our users a brand new language. Number two, it's not only SQL well-known, but it's the third most well-known language after JavaScript and HTML, CSS. So there are 14 million developers today who know SQL. Number three, we like SQL because it allowed us to use all the broad set of tools in the rich SQL ecosystem, from Tableau and Power BI for visualization, to maybe Kafka and Spark for data pipelines. Yeah, so like when we launched, and even today, you know, we're the only time series database that scales and supports SQL. And in fact, because we're built on top of Postgres, that means that even though we launched only maybe 20, 21 months ago, when we launched, we had the broadest and the largest ecosystem of any time series database. And we're built on this rock solid Postgres engine, which, you know, has decades of reliability work into it. So I think our users also found that we were the most reliable time series database as well.
Do you offer a hosted database as a service version, or is that something you plan to offer in the future?
Well, we have something internally right now that's in private beta, and we'll have more news on a hosted version later this year. But we fully recognize that a managed version of Timescale is one of the more requested features, if you will, or capabilities that people, that our community has been asking for. And so that is one of our major focuses at the moment.
Is anyone else hosting a Timescale DB service right now?
I think there may be a few folks in the Postgres ecosystem that do that. But right now, there's no official Timescale sanctioned managed cloud, but that will change in the next few months.
There's this big conversation in the industry about what I call SaaS squatters, and you called open source strip mining. That is basically cloud providers who have economies of scale in hosting and operations offering open source as a service very well.
Yeah.
And sometimes undermining the business models of the open source companies themselves and potentially reducing innovation.
Right.
But how do you feel about that? Do you think that is a positive or a negative?
I really like the way that Jay Kreps from Confluent framed it, which was cloud providers are acting in this way, and we actually don't fault them for it. You know, I think open source licenses to date have been incredibly permissive and allowed for the behavior that they're doing. And the behavior is they're taking, you know, essentially the R&D work by an external community and using that to fuel proprietary projects. And I'm not casting judgment what they're doing, but that's essentially what they're doing. That said, I think this behavior is actually really dangerous for the future of open source in general, because what you essentially have is a bifurcation between the communities that are actually really innovating and driving the state of the art, being separated from the companies who are able to reap the gains from that innovation. And over the long term, that's not sustainable, because then these are communities and organizations that are actually developing open source software. If they can't find sustainable business models, then I think this whole thing falls apart. And so what we were trying to do is to say, look, you know, we're not casting judgment on the cloud providers. You know, we're not even trying to redefine open source. We're just saying that, look, as an open source business, we're trying to strike this balance between, yes, we really love the principles of open source and we're trying to preserve it and we're building a community, but we're trying to do it in a way that allows us to build a sustainable business, because otherwise Timescale will not be around in 5 years. I think our community, the folks who are really benefiting from Timescale DB today, they really want Timescale to be around because this is solving a key problem. So in that way, I think we're totally aligned. But I think this does require, I think, a shift in how we think about open source software. And I think some people are fine with it. And I think some people will need to adjust. I think what we're going through now is a transition in open source that is not the first transition we've gone through. I think in the mid to late 90s, when you had the rise of the OSI, a lot of the early open source folks at that point from the Free Software Foundation called these OSI licenses not open source because they weren't free like GPL, right? They weren't as onerous as GPL. And so there was a backlash then. I think we had a similar backlash maybe a decade ago when open source companies started building out the open core model and they started having two repos. One is open source, one closed. And even then people thought that, oh, if you're an open source business, you know, you need to be doing 100% open source. And there was a backlash. And I think where we are today is that people accept that, hey, open source licenses don't need to be as onerous as GPL. And the people have accepted that, hey, the open core model is a totally acceptable open source business model. And I think where we are today is that another adjustment period, and I fully expect in 5 years, people will say, oh yeah, like, you know, here's an open source company and they struck this balance and we think that's completely fine.
And just to clarify one thing that Ajay said, and I think it's important for us to recognize that we are keeping the vast majority of our code licensed under Apache 2. What this differentiation with certain capabilities that are then licensed under the Timescale license or paid is that saying is ultimately, if you want to find the best version of Timescale in the cloud, that will be provided by Timescale, the company.
I like the way that you've done it too, because you don't have two repositories. You actually have one repository with a folder that has the TSL license code in it. Can you talk a little bit about why you made the decision to structure it that way?
So I think there's both internal and external reasons for doing that. What Ajay already described is a lot of value that people get from certainly value people attribute to open source due to its completely unrestricted for use and modification. But there's also value that they actually see the code. A famous quote that many eyes makes all bugs shallow. And the idea of this is that when this code is all available, even if it's some of it is not under an OSI approved license, then that means developers could always see the code that they're actually running themselves, could become confident of it. And if they happen to ever run into performance issues or perhaps bugs, although of course those never happen, is that they could actually see the code and try to deal with it themselves and ultimately make contributions, carry on their typical developer flows with GitHub and GitHub issues and tracking as they normally would. So we think there's a lot of value from an external perspective. What it also allows us to do is kind of create this continuum of how people could consume the software in their own production. So for example, typically if you'd, let's say, upgrade from an open source or community to a paid version, you'd have to download a new piece of software, reinstall it, migrate your data possibly, and so forth. And the way we developed it, effectively, if you have the community installed, for example, you just need to basically enter a license key and it immediately unlocks all of the paid features. And similarly, actually, deep down internally, there's actually a slightly different binary between the pure open source and the community. And this allows you to upgrade or downgrade without any concern for your production workloads. But internally, this actually also then ensures that because everything's in one repo, you don't ultimately have this divergence between what is the open source version of it and the closed source. And for many companies, when you actually have your open core, the additional things is closed source, you have to spend all this effort of moving various patches back and forth between the two versions. And over time, you find that the features and capabilities between the open source version and the closed source version start to diverge. And this kind of avoids that issue, and it also leads to a lot more transparent software engineering for both the reasons that are external to community contributors as well as internal to our own software developers.
Have you gotten any pushback from customers? Glue, we once had a customer who didn't want any AGPL code on their system at all. And we ended up repackaging one of the AGPL components from Glue as a post-installation download.
People often ask us, well, if you want to go this approach, or, you know, if you're worried about, let's say, the cloud providers, why not just make it GPL? And the answer is GPL is restrictive in other ways. And we thought it was important for many large corporations, many of which, you know, big enterprises sometimes are resistant to GPL, to allow it to be really frictionless in their adoption of the open source, you know, the Apache 2 version of Timescale. Now, regarding this question of have to type in a license key, can you accidentally use things? I just want to be clear in two ways, and just to avoid maybe if there's any confusion. First of all, is that the way we've designed it, and we thought about this carefully, we really want to make it so that people couldn't accidentally be violating a license. And so this is why we actually have a license key in the first place. We could have, for example, just said that, oh, these certain features are commercially available, but there's no actually license, you know, technical restrictions to them. And then what happens is a large organizations could download it, people across their organizations could start using it, and then they run the risk of, did they accidentally, because not everybody understood the terms, started violating the license. And so we really wanted to keep that line between, you know, you can't ever run the risk of violating it through accidental, not understanding the terms of it. And so there has to be an explicit action in order to unlock these additional features. Now, with the use of the community, it really turns out that the main thing that community restricts are really just a narrow scenario, which basically says, if you are a cloud provider, where the only thing you're doing is offering a hosted database as a service, you know, or if you're OEM and you're kind of shipping to the edge and the only thing you're doing is offering the database as that and you're providing no other value, that's the only thing that really the Timescale license restricts from. And so, you know, for many companies, even SaaS companies, and in that sense, we're actually, I think, more restrictive than some of the other recent licenses that also come out. For many SaaS companies, this is not an issue. If you're on-premise, this is not an issue. If you're on the edge, it's not an issue. It really is just an issue if you're looking to deploy Timescale hosted as a service for the community edition. And there's often very little confusion with companies that are they a, you know, a hosted database provider.
Switching tracks a little bit, currently the bulk of your revenues are generated from support and it sounds like you're trying to move to sale of license. Has that process started yet, and how's it going?
It has started, and I would say it's going actually pretty smoothly. You know, I think what's interesting is that, you know, maybe some companies who have a strict open source policy and they only want to use the Apache 2 binary. And I think for folks like that, you know, we have a support and services package in place that makes complete sense. And there are others who are completely comfortable with the idea of a commercial license, of the transition from open source to commercial license. And that's where we can bundle in some of these enterprise features as well as still support and services. And so I think what we've essentially offered people is a choice on what they want. And I think the key thing is that businesses see value from Timescale. You know, they want to make sure that, number one, that they have an insurance policy in place for their production workloads. But some of them also want to make sure that they have all the bells and whistles and the best possible version of Timescale in place. And that's where the kind of the commercial licenses come in.
So I know it's a relatively new company. Have you developed partner channels? And if not, have you thought about what type of partner relationships will be important to you in the future?
Number one, despite being a young company, I think we emerged with already a pretty large community ecosystem thanks to Postgres. And we've been able to have partnership conversations a lot earlier than one would expect. An example, late last year, we announced a collaboration with Grafana, the visualization tool, where we authored the SQL/Postgres connector to Grafana. And even last week, Zabbix, which is a kind of a monitoring tool, you know, announced support for Timescale. And so I think one thing you're finding is that with the rise of time series data and the ubiquity of Postgres, there's already this latent demand for folks who want to partner to provide the best time series SQL experience to their users. You know, that said, I think there's a lot more we could be doing. It'll be more that we'll be announcing this year. But in general, if you're someone in the ecosystem, or if you're like an SI or a consulting firm and you see the value of time series in SQL, then I think, you know, we're trying to be the best partner that you could work with.
And I think along that lines, the point about a Postgres ecosystem is that there's already both a huge install base, but also a huge ecosystem around Postgres, both in terms of SIs and consultants and service providers and whatnot. And so what we find is that many of them have customers and clients that have time series needs. And as Jay pointed out, as more and more people are figuring out that many forms of data, and we like to say all data is time series, and they want to start using and understanding it better, the fact that Timescale is so well integrated and compatible with Postgres means that this is a natural way that they could take some of their own existing data infrastructure that they know and love and now get all these new capabilities for time series data with it.
So this question is sort of from left field. IBM just announced recently an acquisition of Red Hat. What do you think that means for the industry?
I think Red Hat's acquisition by IBM, I think, is incredibly validating for open source. And it's not the first validation. And in fact, like another major validation was last year when Microsoft acquired GitHub. And I found that probably even more remarkable given all the history Microsoft has had of being combative to open source, for example, under the Steve Ballmer days. But I think now is what you're finding with that acquisition and now with Red Hat IBM, as open source is really validated as a viable software development, distribution, and business model. And I think in the past, I think people had thought, oh, open source was just free and it's the cheap product. And maybe, you know, that's where things started. But what we found now is that the value of open source is more than free. And in fact, it's often the leading technologies and the best technologies are open source. So it's a real shift. And I think what we'll see over the next few years is that we'll find even more open source success stories, you know, for example, in the form of multi-billion-dollar sustainable businesses.
I also think it shows one more thing in that sometimes people refer to the open source business model, but I think it's important to distinguish that there are, in fact, multiple different open source business models. And this often leads to the nature of the different type of open source companies. Red Hat, part of what they were doing from the beginning was putting together and packaging an incredibly complex ecosystem that was your operating system distribution, then ultimately building services on top of that. If you have other types of open source businesses like Cloudera and Hortonworks, who are bringing together many different types of open source tools and types of infrastructure, and then delivering them as part of a broader solution. On the flip side, have types of open source companies like Mongo and Elastic and Confluent and us, who are the major contributors behind each of their technologies, but are bringing a more purpose-built type of software infrastructure to the market as opposed to accumulating. So all of these are actually different forms of businesses, but they all have something in similar. But I think they're similarly going to take slightly different paths and see different reactions from the market.
Is there a certain type of software that you think lends itself to open source?
I think that one thing that has happened is people move from thinking that only proprietary and closed source software was sufficiently enterprise ready to thinking that if you're running software, you know, low-level software infrastructure, it almost de facto has to be open source. And part of that transition is related to the notion of ultimately want to see and trust the code that you're running. Open source gives people confidence of that. You want to have a viable path to self-run it. If for whatever reason, you don't want to allow other companies to really control your destiny. So the fact of open source gives you confidence in that. And I think there's an increasing belief that the community can contribute. And again, this notion of all many eyes makes bugs shallow is that in the end, we could deliver high quality code that fits a lot of different use cases by being open source.
The last question, any advice for new entrepreneurs who want to start a business that is developing open source software?
My number one piece of advice would be to scratch your own itch. I think is one thing I've learned through this experience and through, you know, past companies as well, is that building a company is really hard. And I think it's harder than, say, you know, the tech media and Twitter and LinkedIn make it seem, because there's obviously a lot of selection bias in the press. And it's hard, not just because you need product market fit, but you also need team market fit. You essentially need all the stars to align that the world needs something and that you're the right people to build it. I think it's really hard to artificially create that. And so I think the best way is just scratch your own itch. If there's something that's missing in the market and that you have a really strong burning need to build and you feel confident that you could be the best person to build this, then build it and then get more people involved and get feedback and let it snowball from there. That's probably step one of a very long journey. And we're still, I would say, really early in that journey. But I think for people starting off, I think that's the piece of advice I would give.
Yes, I think a lot of what Ajay said was correct. And something that we think about a lot and have talked about in the past, that ultimately I think why this interesting move, as we talked about, was we initially were building an IoT platform. One of that is we saw and were familiar with this future with lots of devices sending data. And in fact, some of our background, you know, I probably know, I'm also a professor of computer science at Princeton. A lot of our other early engineering team were former PhDs and postdocs from that, where we had a lot of experience, a lot of this very high-scale distributed data. But that gave us kind of unique experiences about, especially when we were operating this platform, about what you need and how you want to use it. And so, for example, some of the pains we felt was that when we were initially using some of these NoSQL time series databases, we couldn't do the type of queries you want to answer questions for customers. Or we realized that we wanted to ask something new. We had to do this in application space, and you were like, well, I need to get this into an engineering sprint. I can't deploy. Somebody wants to ask a simple query, and it's going to be a month before I could deploy new capabilities. And so when you start feeling that pain yourself, it really helps direct you on a certain roadmap that allows you to ultimately build highly useful product. And you know, I think that sometimes people go after markets because they say, okay, I'm going to do this very hands-off calculations about market opportunities and business forecasting, and going to intellectually derive where there's value. And you know, maybe one could be successful that way, but I think you need to deeply understand your user and how your user will be consuming your technology. And often that's because in the past you've had to be that user yourself.
Congratulations on the success of the company. Thank you for all your hard work, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for your time.
And thank you to the Timescale team for arranging this interview. Transcription and episode audio can be found on opensourceunderdogs.com. Music from Broke for Free, Chris Zabriskie, and Lee Rosevier. Production assistance and transcription by Natalie Lau. Operational support from William Lau. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @FossPodcast. That's FOSS Podcast. Next week, we're interviewing a legend of open source, Martin Dougiamas, founder and CEO of Moodle, the world's leading open source learning management platform. Until then, thanks for listening and have a pleasant journey.